The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation. Hey everyone.
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
And today we wanted to talk to you guys about the medico-legal death investigation.
So a medico-legal death investigator is anyone whose job it is to investigate any death that falls under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner or coroner. So that's all suspicious, violent, unexplained, and unexpected deaths. And the death investigator is essentially responsible for the decedent or the body itself, and they perform a scene investigation to determine the extent to which further investigation is necessary.
And then to bring that into the broader category, the medical legal death investigation system is responsible for conducting death investigations and certifying the cause and manner of unnatural and unexplained deaths. So the medical legal death investigator falls into a very specific and early role within the medical legal death investigation system, of which the medical examiner kind of takes over the second half, which is certifying the cause and manner of those unnatural deaths. But the medical legal death investigator kind of takes that first step. And these are all under the jurisdiction of coroners or medical examiners, be it whatever system they are in. So this is really important because something that may appear to be a natural death on the surface may actually be criminal. And so their job is to kind of tease that out. So about 20% of deaths in the U.S. are investigated by medical examiners and coroners, which is about 450,000. Yes. Sorry, did I say that number right? 450,000 medical legal death investigations annually. So as Nicole said, these include unnatural or unexplained deaths, which could be homicides, suicides, unintentional injuries, drug-related deaths, or other deaths that are sudden or unexpected. And why do these help? So they provide evidence to help convict the guilty and protect the innocent. They aid civil litigation, so malpractice, personal injury, life insurance claims. They can help with public health practice and research by, you know, surveillance, epidemiology, and prevention programs. And they help evaluate the quality of healthcare and nation's response to bioterrorism. And this is kind of like the system at large, which includes both the scene investigation and the body investigation later. And this system really dates back to, I know we did a little history on coroners, medical examiners way back when, but I kind of want to do a brief recap of it now because the medical legal death investigator really falls under the category or under the jurisprudence of the coroner or medical examiner.
Also history is fun.
And it's important to know that this system is run by very different people. As we know, a medical examiner is a physician, usually a forensic pathologist, and a coroner is an elected official that is sometimes a physician, but oftentimes not a physician, and sometimes they're associated with law enforcement. So coroners date back to the 9th and 10th century England. It was formalized into law in the 12th century by King Richard I, and the whole point of coroners was to send them to death scenes to, quote-unquote, protect the crown's interest and collect duties, aka somebody's died, and let's see if we can get some money off of them because we get some percentage of their estate or whatever. And then in the U.S., many of the U.S. colonies had coroner roles written into their bylaws. And then in terms of bringing them towards medical examiners, in 1860, there was a first move towards a medical examiner system in Maryland, which required a physician to be present at the death inquest, as they called it. And then since 1877, there's been this nationwide trend to kind of replace coroners with medical examiners. And this was a big start to this was in Boston and New York. And a lot of states have gone towards medical examiner systems, but this stalled in the mid-1980s. So currently about 25 states have medical examiner systems, and the rest are either all coroner or a mix of coroner medical examiner, depending on the county or district or parish.
That's not complicated at all.
Nope.
So what are the requirements for becoming a medical legal death investigator? There are actually no formal educational requirements. There are several established training courses that are available throughout the country that teach the basic information needed to perform a thorough, competent medical legal death investigation. And there is also a voluntary national not-for-profit independent professional certification board called the American Board of Medical Legal Death Investigators. And they certify individuals who have proven knowledge and skills necessary to perform death investigations as set forth by this guide that we'll be going into a lot more depth about later from the National Institutes of Justice. And each medical examiner and coroner office has different hiring practices and different requirements, and the salaries and benefits vary throughout the United States.
And the origin of kind of these lay examiners working for medical examiners really dates back to the 1950s. And the first formal training course was offered actually in St. Louis University back in 1974.
Oh, nice.
And seven states now mandate minimal training for death investigators. So there's some that do have distinct laws. And those, you know, include things with death scene investigation, examining the decedent, determining time of death, recognizing evidence, notifying next of kin, mass casualty response, organ and tissue donation, testifying in court, and learning about ancillary forensic sciences. So these are things that seven states require you to know about in order to be a death investigator.
Seems reasonable.
Yes. And a death investigator can be recognized as an affiliate of the National Association of Medical Examiners, or they can become members of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. And as Nicole mentioned, in the NIJ, the National Institute of Justice, in 1995, organized the first technical working group to develop guidelines for scene investigation. And this was released in 1998. So, you know, they started working with medical examiners in the 1950s, first formal course in 1974, and then finally we have an actual technical manual that was published in 1998 that we're going to walk through shortly.
We'll be talking about the updated version, which came out in 2011.
Yes. And then what Nicole talked about, the American Board of Medical Legal Death Investigators was created in 1998. So when that technical manual was first released, this group was created to certify death investigators. So within this certification group, there are two levels of certification. You can be registered or board certified, and it recertifies every 5 years. And the goal of this is really to identify professionally qualified death investigators so they can assist the courts and the public in assessing their competence. So they're really trying to get this overarching, you know,
level of standardization.
Yeah, that's, of course, not everybody requires it, so it's difficult, but.
Yep.
So the first thing that this manual includes is, I'm not going to go through all of this, but they essentially list all of the things that you should have in your kit, which I thought it was very smart, but very funny at the same time. You know, basic things like gloves, writing implements, measuring implements. But then there's also things that, you know, make a lot of sense, like paper bags, blood collection tubes, paper envelopes. Foul weather gear was one of them. And I just found it
interesting.
Very smart that they actually have this list. So, you know, you can go through and check things off.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, pocket knife is in there. So it's kind of fun because it's a mixture of things you need to collect evidence on the body, but also some things that you would need to collect evidence on the scene, and also some like personal safety stuff to make sure that, you know, the investigator is safe as well. So that was just a very good comprehensive list.
And if you watch TV shows, some of that stuff might not be quite intuitive, like, you know, gloves.
It's true. God forbid.
Yeah.
You have to leave your prints along with the perpetrator's prints at the scene.
Yes. I mean, only 10 to 15% of cases are homicides anyway, so
it's, you know, fine.
Roll the dice. So going through the guidebook, the first big category is what to do when you arrive at the scene. So one of the first things as a death investigator you want to do is to introduce yourself and identify your role as well as the role of other people at the scene. So often at death scenes, there are a lot of representatives from different agencies. So it's important to establish a kind of hierarchy regarding the scene, like who's going to take care of what, and making sure only essential personnel are around.
Yes.
It's also important to identify the first person who arrived on scene to ascertain if any artifacts or contamination may have been introduced to the scene before you as the death investigator arrived. It's also important to establish scene safety and security. In a lot of different scenes, there's a risk of environmental and physical injury, and those things have to be removed prior to initiating the scene investigation. For example, if this scene is a highway traffic accident, you want to make sure that all of the personnel that are investigating are within safe boundaries so that, you know, the traffic that's going past in other lanes isn't going to hit anybody.
And there are times when police or somebody might be trying to move things along quicker so they can open up traffic, but you really have to push back and make sure that, you know, your investigators are safe first and that you do an appropriate and thorough scene investigation.
Yes. And you also, I found this interesting because it definitely makes a lot of sense, but removal of any treacherous environmental factors, so including animals.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, like if the owner had a dog that's kind of gone a little bit feral, making sure
Cole's trying to eat my face.
Yeah, making sure that Cole is in a cat carrier away from people. And then you also want to confirm or pronounce the death. So the appropriate personnel has to make sure that the dead person is actually dead. And to identify and document who is the person who actually made that determination. And usually, along with the introduction and preliminary things, there will be a scene briefing. So that's just where everybody kind of exchanges initial information regarding the nature of the investigation, giving preliminary details, initial witness information, and divvying up the responsibilities. So then you want to conduct an initial scene walkthrough, and you're trying to minimize the scene as much as possible to prevent the loss and contamination of any physical and fragile evidence. And if you see any such fragile evidence, you want to collect it or photograph it immediately to preserve that. And then you want to establish a chain of custody. So determine which agencies are going to be responsible for collecting which types of evidence, and make sure that you're collecting everything in a proper container with a label and any preservatives that are needed. Document where you're taking everything from and develop a list of witnesses and personnel that are at the scene so you can contact people later. And then you also, and this is, I mean, it's kind of silly, but you want to make sure that you're following laws the entire time that you're doing all of this. Making sure that federal laws are being followed, jurisdictional laws are being followed. So if you need to have a warrant for any reason, making sure that you get that before you do anything that could get you in trouble.
So the next step is documenting, like, the actual documentation and evaluation of the scene. So the first step is kind of what Nicole just talked about, was a quick walkthrough. Anything that might be gone, you take a quick picture of it, collect it so it doesn't go away. But really the next step is all of your documenting, evaluating, and making sure that you don't lose anything at the scene. So first step is to photograph literally everything. So pictures of both the full scene from all different angles, and then the body and the evidence from all angles. And the number of photographs that we sometimes see from some of these scene investigations is a lot, but it's very helpful. So you pretty much, once you take a picture, you don't throw it away, but there's just a lot of pictures. The next step would be written documentation of this. So, you know, you diagram everything out, you make a list of all of your evidence, you really make sure that nothing falls through the cracks, because this is all things that might have to be brought to court later. So, you know, take pictures of everything, write everything down, and make sure that they all link up. The next step is to establish the probable location of the injury or illness. So, you might have a body in one place, but then you see evidence of a struggle. You see drag marks. You see that the live or a rigor, so the color or the movement of the body doesn't make sense for where the body actually is. That kind of goes into the next step too, but you kind of take all of these things together and you're like, well, the body is here, but there's a trail of blood leading from this other area. So why don't I take a lot of pictures and document evidence from the other area leading up to the body to really make sure that we have the whole scene documented well. And this is something that the police will probably also be doing, hopefully also be doing, but really it's the job of the death investigator to also get that, because it is really important for the forensic pathologist to use this to bring together for the final cause and manner of death. Next step is evidence collection. So you're going to collect the evidence, you're going to inventory the evidence, and you're going to safeguard the evidence. So you've already taken pictures of it, you've already written it down, now you're going to collect it, write it down again, and then make sure that you protect chain of evidence. And then the final step in this is to go through and interview your witnesses. So you know who's on scene, the family, friend, bystander, whoever it involves, to really figure out what happened just prior to death. Maybe you only know that an hour ago they were feeling sick and lay down and went to bed, but you need to figure out when they felt sick, what does that mean? Really get a full story around that. Or if there was a big fight that a lot of people saw, you'd have to interview the witnesses to make sure that you have a good story of how the decedent was, say, hit or struck or hit the wall or any of that, so you can really tie it all together in the end. So this step is really important to then retrospectively go back. And one of the big jobs of a death investigator is to be able to take all of this information and to synthesize it and to write the report later.
And once you're done dealing with the scene, or, you know, as you were dealing with the scene, you're also going to be documenting and evaluating the body. So that includes lots of photos of the body. So similar to how you took lots of photos of the scene, you want to take a bunch of photographs from different angles of the decedent. You want to make sure that you get a photo of the decedent's face, although you don't want to clean the face in the scene. You don't want to change the condition of the body in any way. You also want to take additional photographs after removal of objects that could interfere with the scene. So like I mentioned before, as an example, if it's a motor vehicle accident and the body is removed from the car, you want to take pictures before the body is removed and then after the body is removed as well. You also want to photograph any surfaces beneath the body after the body has been removed, just to document like fluids, blood stains, anything like that. And then after you photograph, you want to conduct an external body examination, and this is all superficial. And you're looking for things like postmortem change. You want to take note of any tattoos, which could be helpful in establishing things like an identification later on.
Physical characteristics, clothing, personal effects, mark scars and tattoos for ID later on. Injury trauma that you can see without removing clothing, that kind of thing.
Yep. And then any evidence that you see on the body that could be displaced in transit, you want to collect then and there. So things like hair or fibers that could be moved. You also want to do things like put clean paper bags over the hands to preserve any evidence that might be under the fingernails that might get lost in transit as well.
I also saw in this, when you're collecting some fluid on the body or surroundings sometimes, if you think they might like dry up or go away.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And then if you're an ME going to the scene, you might do some other body collections, like semen collection or something like that. But that's not something that a medical legal death investigator would do. But a medical forensic pathologist that went to the scene might take that earlier. But usually you wait till you get back to the morgue. But it's something you could take on scene.
Which might make listeners wonder, when then does the medical examiner or coroner come to the actual scene versus just the investigators? And so it's based on all of the findings that the death investigators are seeing at the scene and with the body, they determine the need for further evaluation. Okay. So if they see something that they're not sure about, they're a little worried that maybe this is a homicide, even though initially it didn't look like one, then they will call the forensic pathologist to come out and determine whether or not additional services or specialists are required. Another thing that the death investigator will do is they will determine the notification procedures for the next of kin or interested and authorized individuals. So another important thing that the death investigator will do is to try to establish the identification of the individual. And they can do this preliminarily by things like direct visual or photographic ID. So if there is a driver's license on the person, and then they can also use circumstantial methods. So personal effects, as we mentioned before, tattoos, physical characteristics, other things like that. Later on, if these methods are not sufficient, scientific methods can be used, like fingerprints, dental, radiographic, and DNA comparisons. But usually those things are done later on in the morgue, like they'll fingerprint the decedent, take the x-rays and things like that later.
They could also, since you have family there, have the family directly ID the next of kin on scene.
Yeah.
It's something that really, once you're left that scene, it's not impossible, more difficult to do. But if there is somebody there that can possibly identify them, let's just do it live.
And then they also need to, speaking of kin, if the kin are not on scene, they need to figure out notification of next of kin or individuals that are authorized and interested in the decedent. So if they themselves do not do that, they need to record the time of notification that another agency did and obtain the documentation and of confirmation that that notification was performed. A death investigator also needs to ensure the security of the remains at the scene. So
pretty much make sure that they don't get, you know, the family member doesn't come and take something. They need to make sure that the body intact gets to the morgue in one piece.
Yes. They also need to identify any inventory that will be coming with them.
That they know of. Sometimes they don't know all of it, yeah. But yeah.
And that's when they will also place the identification on the body and put the body in a body bag for security.
And then to complete the scene investigation, it's kind of like what Nicole just said, leading to it getting to the medical examiner or coroner's office. You have to maintain jurisdiction over the body from when it gets to the scene until it is safely in the morgue, and then maintain it through the autopsy or the remainder of the death investigation procedure. So, you know, they close the body bag and seal it, and then it comes to the morgue. And while it's at the morgue, it's, you know, relatively safe behind locked doors. The forensic pathologist will bring it out. They'll do their autopsy. But then it's still the thing that a lot of people don't think about is that the death investigators are involved with releasing jurisdiction of the body. So they're also involved in helping coordinate getting the death certificate signed out, seeing where the body's going to go. Is it going to go to a funeral home? Is it, or which funeral home is going to go to? Or what other steps are going to happen from there? If it needs to be kept at the medical examiner's office because nobody's claiming the body, how long do we keep it for? What are the disposal? Are we going to cremate after 3 months and then have a ceremony to release a bunch of bodies at some point in the future? There's a lot of coordination over the release of the bodies that the death investigators do get involved with. So the death investigation isn't just the scene, it's also the body through the point that it gets sent out to wherever it's going to go. And then the final thing they do is probably, in my mind, the most important. They're involved in assisting the family. So as Nicole said, they notify next of kin, but really they update the family on an autopsy requirement. So is an autopsy going to have to happen? Who can they contact to get updates on the autopsy, when it's going to be released, how the family can get the body, how they coordinate with the funeral home, what is the timetable, how much is this going to cost? You know, make sure the family isn't left alone with the body so they can't tamper with evidence or take something that they shouldn't yet take. Because, you know, they'll eventually get, unless it's needed for evidence, what's left on the body. But, you know, they can't have it quite yet. So they do have a very, very important role in coordinating with the family who is, you know, now the live person that we have, that we are doing this for.
Yes. Yes. And something that's not part of the scene that death investigators also do is they, if it's needed, get the clinical history of the patient. So they'll get medical, mental health, and social history records. And the forensic pathologist can use those to determine whether or not an autopsy is needed even. But that's all the things that they do after they come back from the scene.
And then the final step that a death investigator would have to do in any case is possibly testify at trial. Mm. So as Nicole said, the forensic pathologist doesn't always go to the scene. The coroner doesn't always go to the scene. Sometimes you just have a death investigator, which is trained by the coroner medical examiner system, go to the scene. So they're the first person there, and they're the ones that are going to have to go to court and testify. So all that documentation that they did at the beginning, they can then go back and look at. And then they not uncommonly have to testify to what they saw at the scene when they got there. So it's not just cops that do that. It's also the medical legal death investigators. So they really do run the full gamut. They pretty much do a lot of the work for the forensic pathologist.
Yeah, without the valuable information that they bring in, we would not be able to determine cause and manner of death.
And it's very interesting that different places that I've been have different interactions and different relationships with the medical legal death investigators. I've only really been in a medical examiner system, and all three that I've seen have worked very closely and have very good relationships with their death investigators, but I know that it's very different across the country.
And just a couple other things that I saw while I was doing research for this episode were, in light of the current pandemic, there has been kind of some talk about whether or not medical examiner and coroner personnel, including death investigators, should be classified as first responders. And that's because a lot of state and local jurisdictions have been giving additional benefits like hazard pay to first responders in light of the pandemic. And medical examiner, coroner, and medical legal death investigator personnel are at risk of exposure.
Yes.
So when they respond to death scenes, they are interacting with other representatives at those death scenes. They're interacting with family, so that's increased exposure. They're transporting and handling bodies, performing or assisting in postmortem examinations, have mortuary functions, handling and testing lab specimens. So all of these instances put them at risk for being exposed to COVID-19. So the National Association of Medical Examiners and the International Association of Coroners and Medical Examiners have both released position papers stating that local and federal government should be considering medical examiner and coroner personnel as first responders, even though in a lot of places they currently aren't. So to be determined if that changes and they start to see some benefits from that.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing the way that people, you think of a first responder and you think of somebody that's responding to a live person, but you think of something like COVID and you're like, well, they're dead. You're not going to get it from them. But, you know, as long as air is moving in and out of your lungs, you can spread something. And if you move a body because you have to move it from the bed to the body bag, to the gurney, to the medical examiner's office, you're pushing on the chest and air is still being expelled, even if they're not doing it themselves. So these people are really exposed and they're quite literally on the front lines. And oftentimes various organizations are not giving them appropriate PPE and not requiring appropriate PPE. And so then even if they don't necessarily want to wear it, they're then bringing it back into the office and exposing everybody there. And it's just kind of, you know, this whole ball of wax that, you know, you need to really cut it off at the quick before anything happens. And having resources to do this is really important. So hopefully some of these national movements will help out.
Yes. And the other thing in that same vein is post-traumatic stress disorder in coroners and medical examiner personnel. So there's been a lot of research that first responders have a higher risk of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And common situations that are encountered by death investigators include like grisly murder scenes, mass shootings with multiple fatalities, child homicides, suicides, working with mutilated bodies. So all of those things also put them at risk for PTSD, but it hasn't been as well studied. And that's kind of coming to the forefront now with this increased consideration of them as first responders as well. So there was this paper that I was looking at that was just saying that increased awareness and provision of resources is necessary going into the future. And they talked about this voluntary program that has been tested out called the Assaultive Staff Action Program, where they actually train personnel in crisis counseling, and that helps them in dealing with the families to decrease their own emotional stress, but also helps them when discussing stressful situations with their colleagues to help their colleagues when they're in stress.
Kind of like that, identify things first in your coworkers and don't let them bring it home.
Yeah. And when I was reading more things about PTSD in medical examiner and coroner personnel, I came across this Vice article by Joseph Scott Morgan. And he began his career at the coroner's office in New Orleans and then worked at the Fulton County Medical Examiners in Atlanta for about 30 years. So he participated in 7,000 forensic autopsies and did more than 2,000 next of kin death notifications, and eventually was forced to retire in 2005 after suffering from crippling anxiety and PTSD. Gotcha. And when you read through this article, he is just so jaded and talks about this severe loss of empathy while he was working. He was just so burnt out. And it's definitely something that I've thought about for myself, and even things that I've had to think about in residency. Like, you know, when we're on a tough surgical rotation, remembering that we have this stack of slides and each flat belongs to an actual person, and trying to not burn out and give as much emotional energy as I can to each case.
Yeah, I definitely think, like, for anybody in the medical field, I feel like every field has that in some way, right? The medical field definitely has it, because you don't remember the healthy patients, you remember the sick patients.
Yeah.
But even things like, you know, social workers are dealing with an astounding number of interpersonal issues that you then come home and your family just had a fight. But to the other member of your family, that is huge. But in your mind, you're comparing it to this big, crazier thing that you saw. Yeah. And it's hard to keep that perspective sometimes. And of course, these are extremes. Seeing thousands, literally thousands of people dying changes your worldview. But it's hopefully that's what we have our families to come home to keep us grounded.
Yes, it's definitely important to have a solid support system if you are going into this field, no matter what role you are thinking of entering into.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. Life's crazy.
Death's crazy, too.
Death is very crazy. Speaking of being over-inundated by one particular thing, so schmeeds.
Nice. Reminds me that I have not fulfilled my promise of being more active on our Twitter page. So if you liked this and any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. It's how we get boosted up on the various podcasting platforms and other people hear about us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we link to all of our sources and our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at deadmendo.
On Insta, we're at the Dead Tale Tales.
And our Facebook page is Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, you can send us an email with questions, comments, saying hi,
concerns,
through the website or directly to our email at thedeadtaletales@gmail.com.
And our opening theme music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.